Hi everyone, welcome to part four of Audio Terror, the mini-series which will be going out both on Expedition to the Grizzly Peaks and Grizzly Peaks Radio. So for my actual play listeners who can't bear the thought of listening to two idiots talking about theory, you can probably skip this. Well, at least one idiot, because the person I got with me is probably a little bit a notch above idiot status. It's Barney Dicker of Loco Ludus fame, but you'll know him as a couple of beloved characters, or possibly three now. I'm trying to think. Three beloved characters from our actual plays. So he played Anton... what was his name? I was going to say Anton Corbin, but that's not who it is.
Wasn't it a place?
Was it Quebec? Anton Quebec.
Quebec.
Who's Anton Corbin? He's a filmmaker, is he?
He's the photographer who does a few. Yeah, does some film, you know, music videos as well. But he's the photographer. Yeah. Did those amazing photographs for
of
the cover
Joy Division.
Of U2's Atom Baby.
Oh right, and he made the Joy Division film, didn't he?
Did he?
I think he did.
Oh, yes, he did. Yeah.
That was great. Anyway, you play Anton Quebec. You've played Sir Hector Rick. Rigby Iswell. Risby Ickwell. And
yeah,
now.
Hector
and,
oh, Risby Ickwell, yeah.
And then, briefly, in a brief comic turn, I'd like to think of as Barry the photographer. And we won't tell anyone your other character, because that has not been broadcast yet, and that is there.
My new character, yeah, that's under wraps, isn't it?
So I start these with giving you a little moment to tell everyone a little bit about your gaming sort of life. Very briefly, though, because obviously it could go on for a long time. I mean, where do you come from? What do you do?
Where do I come from? What do I do? Well, this weekend, let's just give you an example. It's been a very Cthulhu-oid weekend. We played our latest Hush Hush installment on Saturday night, and then on Sunday I ran I ran Masks of Nyarlathotep in one session. I cut out everything else and we focused only on confronting Nyarlathotep.
Oh, Jesus.
I used my own system, the League of Eternal Guardians, which you know well. So I sent in a load of guardians to confront Nyarlathotep, and they did. They teleported him to another dimension. I suppose I'd also add that I re-edited the whole Egypt stuff in Nyarlathotep. I gave it a different logic, a different momentum.
Now, I'm fascinated by this. How much of it did you read?
I read all of the Egypt bit.
Really?
I cut out the market and all that stuff.
Just to run a one shot.
Okay. I read the Under the Sphinx, and I read in Nyarlathotep's inner sanctum.
Yeah.
And I basically melded those two together because it makes much more sense.
It does. I mean, it is a bit weird, the structure there, that the big bad guy isn't in the climactic scene. You know, they have these two separate... And it makes sense from a sandbox perspective, but dramatically it's a bit weird.
My concept was that Clive...
Holy
Dr.
shit!
Clive,
sorry! Whoa. Spoilers on. I've just realised. I'm going to cut me saying spoilers on and insert it before this bit, because we will at some point, I don't know when in the future, be publishing all these episodes of the full campaign. So, but anyway, carry on. It's all right. We've got spoilers.
Say it again.
Spoilers on.
I'll be quiet now. Say it again.
Spoilers on.
That's the one. Excellent. Okay. So, well, I mean, it's not a spoiler if I've mangled it, is it?
No,
it's not
that's
a spoiler
true.
If I mangled it. But basically, what I decided was that Clive, Dr. Clive, who's been leading one of the excavations, he is possessed by the spirit of Nyarlathotep, and that's kind of when they got into the inner sanctum. And at that moment, the the inner sanctum, sorry, not the temple, or the chamber of Nyarlathotep, that certain elements of it endured, but it transformed into the inner sanctum. So it was this kind of double dimensional space. So but Clive was...
Do they
was,
have... Was, sorry, on. So did they have to encounter all the enemies in the temple first?
No, or, I mean, in the temple, in the main room. But yeah. We pretty much cut to the chase. Didn't get lost in the corridors, you know, none of that.
Okay.
Business.
So did they have to fight the Sphinx, the Black Sphinx?
I actually didn't include that in the end because I had loads of children of the Sphinx, which were pretty brutal as well.
They are. But I love the way that Black Sphinx appears. It puts the shits up players, I find.
Yeah, I wanted to do it. I wanted to do it, but I realized that I very nearly just destroyed them.
Yeah.
With all of the bad guys. But what I did was, what I did as well was that I thought Nyarlathotep can incarnate not too much trouble. And instead of having a brotherhood of the
Black Pharaoh,
I decided to have sisters of Nitocris. So
basically, you look at you.
Yeah. So basically, it's all about reincarnating Nitocris, which he wants to happen, and her reincarnation is synchronized with the solar eclipse, which leads to the great apocalypse.
Oh, I like it. I like that.
Yeah.
But the bigger question is, why did you run it at all? How did it come about?
Well, this has got a connection to you, hasn't it? Because as we've been knocking about with the League of Eternal Guardians, I said to you, "Hey, Andy, would you be up for trying it with a pre-written adventure?"
What you mean, one that someone has written before you read it? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. So I asked you if you would run a published scenario. And I don't know, at some point a while ago, I just thought, well, I'll give it a go as well.
Okay, but it's an interesting choice you made then to run that one. Because I'd have thought much easier to run something that is designed as a short 3-hour sort of thing, if you're going to do that.
But Andy, you've got to remember that with League of Eternal Guardians, it's high octane.
Yeah.
You want something. You want some high stakes. So,
true.
So you know, something where you're investigating a mythos apparition inside someone's shoe.
That's not quite. But we weren't playing League of Eternal Guardians, were we? Huh?
Well, I was
last
yesterday.
Session. No, but the shoe.
Oh no! Oh, I know that. I'm just freestyling this kind of sarcastic, facetious thing.
No, but you're right, and this brings us very neatly, I think, on to a discussion that we're having that's starting to emerge around creating horror, which really is what this little series is about. It's about whether it is possible to create the same kind of feelings of horror, creepiness, possibly fear in a listener by making an actual play, which I think can be done, but I also have my doubts. I know very clearly, as I've explained in exhaustive and exhausting detail, about how all these horror audio drama podcasts do it to varying degrees of success. Clearly, you can do it with an audio drama. And what I'm trying to explore with these games and with these conversations with you and the other guys is whether we think we can, and if we do think we can, how do we do it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the focus is to create something scary for listeners. That's the prime aim, is it? Yeah.
Yes. And I'm interested also in your high octane approach from League of Eternal Guardians and your suggestion that you kind of need to create that intensity right from the off. You can't have this meandering investigation because that sort of deflates the tension somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
So, would you care to expand on that?
Sure. I think one of the players said something like it was grisly or gory or something what we did. There's the pool in Nyarlathotep
Oh,
in
yeah.
the the chamber of Nyarlathotep
Yes.
with the leeches. I decided to have a massive leech with kind of teeth or outward teeth or blades, claws, something. And all of these women who were in the cult all at some point all just jumped in, and it just mangled them up and chopped them up, and they're stuck on the spikes and the water's all red. And so that was quite a gory moment. And I think that's aside from any humor that might come with it. So I guess what I'm saying is to what extent is the shock of gore important, and what's the connection with humor? Because what you're also talking about, I think, is that we have to be serious as well. And I'm up for that. I'm up for that. But I do think you can be shocking and scary, potentially, and still be a bit humorous.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is possible. I think it's a tricky line to tread because on one end you veer into the, I suppose. I'm just trying to think of good examples. I mean, I think I brought this up last time, but the Mr. Creosote in The Meaning of Life is extremely gory, but it's just funny. Although it is, I guess, depending on your mindset looking at it, it is a bit of disturbing as well at the same time, I suppose. All of those things together. Whereas,
But I yeah, go on.
no, and then the other thing I think of perhaps is Shaun of the Dead, which I think sort of does both, but really is a comedy more than anything.
I mean, I would be much more inclined to talk about, Brain Dead, the Peter
Right,
Jackson
yes,
movie, because that is just unbelievably gory,
yes.
or bad taste as well. But yeah. So that's the thing. Is it gore? Is it gore that's important? Is it
Well,
important to be gory?
I think it is a big part of it, particularly in the audio experience, or maybe the gaming audio experience. I think there's actually all these different kind of balances that you need to think about. And what I immediately went to is Stephen King's three levels of horror. And what I probably didn't realize when I was talking about it is that apparently he thinks these are three, almost like a progression of horror, that the gross out gore horror is your most basic type of horror, probably the least powerful, least sophisticated. The second is the appearance of the uncanny and terrifying monster. That's your second level. And the third level is this creeping dread, the terror of the thing just glimpsed out of the corner of the eye that isn't there when you look, but you know is stalking you through the dark. And he thinks that. And so what I'm speculating on is that those three levels of horror exist, in the best horror that you get all three of them to some extent. Like Alien is a classic example where you've got all three of those in really perfect balance until the very end when you see the alien because they just didn't have the costume effects were a bit silly at the very, very end. But up to that point, they've got the gross out stuff, they've got the horrific monster, and they've got this terrible tension and fear and of the unknown and all that kind of business.
And I mean, I know that the original alien monster, I know you can see the person in the suit, but I think they do a good effort to make it other. That head is, and the tail are so other. And because of how they've built the film up, you are kind of thinking, all right, okay. I mean, of course you think she'll survive, because it's classical enough.
I didn't know that the first time I saw it. I didn't think she was going to survive because I thought, how could you survive against this thing? I mean, I was quite young when I saw it as well, so I was just shitting myself, basically. Yeah. I think I was about 14 when I saw it. Not a good idea. I might have been even younger.
But, you know, but Alien 3, I think, in many ways, has a lot more successful stuff. I mean, the first one,
really?
I love. The second one, I think, is terrible. The third one, I think, has got some fabulous, fabulous stuff going on. Yeah, what is it when Brian...
Yeah, Brian...
God. What's his name?
Dennehy? No, Brian Cox. No, not Brian Cox.
No, it's not Brian Cox, is it?
But yeah, I know. Anyway. The Northerner. The He was in Kes. Exactly. He was in Kes, wasn't he?
And Bottom.
Yeah. Anyway, but it's...
When he gets fucked out, when he gets pulled up from the ceiling or whatever, that's brilliant. You know, there's some really weird, gory stuff in number three, which I think is good. But what I wanted to say is I think one of the best horror movies is Ravenous.
I've never seen it.
I've never seen it. I really, really think it is really, really good. It's really good.
So
it's got all of those levels in it.
You know. We talked about this. I talked about this with Spencer, and we couldn't remember the name of it. But now, he did remember afterwards, so he sent it to me. Have you seen Hereditary?
No.
Okay, so there's no point talking about it. Have you seen Midsommar?
No.
Midsommar. Okay, we won't talk about that and then either. No. Have you seen any horror film in the last 5 years? Any contemporary horror?
No.
Okay. All right. what was the last horror film you saw?
I can't remember.
Have you seen The Conjuring?
No.
Have you seen the original Frankenstein? Have you seen the original Frankenstein? I'm just going.
Yeah, but Bride of Frankenstein is much better.
It is.
And it basically recaps the first film at the beginning, so you don't need to watch the first one, which is quite boring. Bride of Frankenstein.
Oh, you think it's boring?
Doctor, what's it? Forgetting everyone's name. No, but I mean, the second one is just it's like
it is better in most ways, yeah.
And it's got the first film in it, so you get two films for the price. but look, what you asked me about is this high octane aspect and getting into it. If this was what are my philosophies about that? I think just finding a body is not enough. I think there needs to, and I don't they have this, don't they have this at the beginning of Two-Headed Serpent, where
it starts with a shooting with a death.
But that's what I'm getting at. I think something has to occur right in front of your face. That gives you the feeling like it could have been somebody else. It could have been anyone. That it happens. It's not static. Like, oh, what's that? Oh, someone's had their head torn off. You need to see the head get torn off.
I mean, finding a body...
And that's where you would ask for a horror role.
Finding a body is a pretty classic way of starting a scary story, though, isn't it?
But this is the problem. This is the whole problem of it. If we're talking about high octane, it's got to be an event. You can find more bodies later on because you've already sown the seeds of what this is like. If some creature were to pop up and just decimate someone and it was almost too fast for anyone to really see, that is far more vivid than this kind of chronological, it looks like it could have been a wolf.
In a way, just to go back to Alien again for a minute, you're right, because the very first thing that happens of any, I mean, yes, they find all the eggs, but the first thing that happens is someone gets this horrific thing happening to them that starts the whole process.
Yeah.
And it is shocking, it's violent, it gets your heart racing. But I think we're confusing two things a bit here. We're confusing excitement, high octane, with scariness. The two aren't the same thing. They can be, but they aren't necessarily the same thing.
What I'm saying is that if you turn up at a crime scene and find the remains of something, and you have time to look at it and study it. It's not, there's no pace, there's no pressure, there's no danger, really.
Okay.
If something is happening, if something happens where you are forced to make quick decisions, that you might be out of your depth with, that can do it. And then you can have oh, that was the cook. You can go back to that mode later because you've shored everybody up. But if we're talking about hooking people in, it's got to start with a bang. And I mean, if I don't know, Touch of Evil or something. If you think of all the way that films begin, I was just thinking of starting with something impactful. And with that, and with Touch of Evil, you see the guy planting the bomb in the car, and then you see the car drive, and it goes on and on and on. And so that's how the suspense builds. And then the payoff, of course, is that it does blow up. Not that it doesn't blow up. And that partly kicks. Well, I mean, it kicks the whole film off in all different kinds of ways. And of course it's mapped out on the border, the American-Mexican border. So it's all of these lots of elements conspiring. So I think there has to be a certain density. So I think that the kind of the high octane thing is actually when you have lots of things happening at the same time. So if we imagined a generic kind of action movie, you've got terrorists. That's bad enough as it is, but these guys are really nasty. They're killing people right, left, and center. So not only are they terrorists, they're re really nasty terrorists. And where are they? They are, I don't know, in the Pentagon, or they're somewhere significant. They're in Fort Knox. Whatever. So not only are they terrorists, they're really bad terrorists. And where are they? They are in somewhere of great social significance and probably economic value. Then who is their main hostage? Well, it just so happens to be the wife, daughter, parents, dog of the hero, or something like that. So you've actually got this kind of tight braiding of things conspiring, which on the one hand draw that's like a it's like it creates a really dense focal point, so it draws everything towards it, plus it makes the situations much more difficult and challenging, because there are personal connections, there are these bigger social connections, and because they're all convolutedly combined, you can't just pull at one and expect the best, because the parents have been fitted with explosive jackets or something, and it's.
So, explosive
Yeah.
gerbils,
And they've been poisoned.
gerbils wired, poisoned, exploding gerbils. So, now, the interesting thing for me is that I'm wondering whether, if we can create tension in the game for the players, whether that then immediately translates to tension in to a listener, because how we're not going to be performing exactly. I mean, we do perform to some extent when we do these actual plays, but we're actually trying to progress the game, I think, more than performing, or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe you have a different opinion on that. But I don't know the answer to this, but I'm wondering whether if we can create something that genuinely makes us tense as we're playing, whether that can be a amplify the horror in to the listener, to the audio recording.
I mean, just to say, I totally agree with progressing the game. I want to provide you with as much. I want to give you as much pushback as I can, right? I want to act as extensively within the space as I can. What's really important for me as a player is also to try and generate situations where I can draw in other people, the other players. So most of the time, the things I do have some connection to other players, either to facilitate something that they could do, or I try and involve them in some way. So it's always this group effort, and the antagonism between the players and the GM, I think, is a good and healthy one. And, you know, who knows where the story exactly is going? So as long as you're pushing, as long as you're moving on, I think you are always going in the right direction. It's like a scrolling video game to a degree, isn't it?
One of the things you often see in horror movies is a lot of tension between the protagonists as well, and suspicion and blurry motives, and not quite knowing where you stand and who is the villain and who is on your side. Mm-hmm. Is that something you think we should try and play up in this experiment?
That's interesting. I mean, it's often also to do with resources as well, isn't it? It's information,
yes,
and it's resources. If there's only one parachute left, brings out the worst in people. Do I think we should?
It's not good for most games, though, is it? Except Paranoia, let's say.
Well,
PvP doesn't tend to be good for games.
But then, you know, one of the interesting things in the second Alien, you know, in Aliens, the second one, is Burke, isn't it? You know, comedy name, of course. But you know that he wants to actually take the aliens back. So if people had that kind of motive, if we as characters had specific motives, if one of us knew more than the others, that could be quite good, quite interesting. And I mean, you know, Dead of Winter is a fantastic board game. I don't know if you've played that.
I've never played it. I know it.
It's really, really good. And it's a wonderful, it's got a wonderful, it sits in a wonderful place between a role play game and a board game. It's really good. And each character has their own, there's a group aim.
Agenda.
And exactly. And they have their own individual agendas. And if you get too suspicious of someone, you can chuck them out of the group. Which is quite interesting.
Yeah, quite so, right.
So, quite I mean, I would thoroughly right. recommend that you play that. But go on.
Yeah, I've read the rules and it looks cool, and I do one day will play it. But the other thing that happens is corruption and players or characters rather being changed and corrupted. Mm-hmm. You know, like the mm-hmm. Thing, of course, is the mm-hmm. classic example mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. Do you think also, again, it's hard to really, you know, the problem I've always had with doppelgangers in D&D mm-hmm. is that, you know, they just don't work. They just do not work in the role-playing game because you kind of got to get one of the whole thing just doesn't work. I can't even go into it now, but you know what I mean. It works beautifully in fiction, but it doesn't work in a game.
Well, now from your games, I know that you don't have a problem with this either. Splitting the party. The great secret, the untapped reservoir of potential is splitting the party. Splitting the party 5 meters, 10 meters, different rooms in the same building, different cities, whatever. Splitting the party is brilliant because if you split the party, then you don't necessarily know what's happening. Now, I don't know how bonkers we want to be about this, but for example, if we split the party and then you did a session, you did a session with that one part of the group, and then you did another session with the other part of the group, and they don't know what's happened. All kinds of things could happen with that. And I think then with editing,
well,
there could be some interesting things.
Well, it's very interesting to say that because that's exactly what we did. And we've already released those episodes because in our Mask campaign, mm-hmm. At one point, this very powerful sorceress, she can take the likeness of someone mm-hmm. and she captures and becomes one of the player characters. And then that player then played her character but as the sorceress in disguise for a couple of sessions. Mm-hmm. And it was great. Mm-hmm. It worked really well in the game because no one knew in the game mm-hmm. except me and her, because we did a separate one-on-one mm-hmm. session. Mm-hmm. And the listener doesn't know. You sort of know at one point because the reveal comes halfway through, but then the players also played it up from that point on that they didn't know. And then, of course, all kinds of things started happening. So, yeah, absolutely. I not only like that idea, I've done it, and I think mm-hmm. it works. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that could be cool. So there's two other topics. I hope we don't want to keep you too long. The next one is something that's Safer. Have you listened to Safer Fantasy Crafting's latest episode?
I haven't, but I will.
It's more or less a response to my last episode. And he talks about this fourth type of horror, which Stephen King doesn't address, mm-hmm. that he finds much more interesting, Safer. Mm-hmm. And I think he's definitely onto something here. So we've talked about the gross-out horror, the monster horror, and the creeping terror. Mm-hmm. But he also, his favourite type of horror is existential mm-hmm. horror, the horror of knowing something, either about you or about someone else or about the universe. And of course, given that this is Lovecraftian horror we're trying to mm-hmm. get to here, it's a big part of that. So I think that's something that can work very well in an audio format. That moment of revelation when the protagonist realizes what's really going on, and that sickening feeling in the pit of their stomach, and you get the revelation at the same time as a listener. Is that something we think we can do in the game? Or is it too elusive, too sort of subtle?
I think that is something for the listener. We can create that for the listener if they're listening to it in that particular kind of way. But I think it comes back to that question that we know we're playing a horror game. What I could imagine to get hold of is the revelation of what specific kind of horror it is that we're dealing with. But, you know, we are, as far as I understand it, we are still trying to have some characters that are surprised by this horror, which we aren't, because we're recording podcasts about it beforehand.
Yeah. That's my thought.
And I think you're going to have to surprise us with stuff. You're going to have to really make us jump a little bit, and we're going to have to respond to that. We're going to have to act up a little bit on that, I think.
Yeah, I think that it'd be great if I can make you jump, but if I can't, we're going to have to pretend as if you jumped.
Well, that's what I mean. What I mean you know? Is I think yeah. there'll be a way of doing it where you can spring some stuff on us, and we have to exaggerate that a little bit. And then when you're editing it, you can tighten it. But I'm getting away from existentiality here, existentialism.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, that has to be for that to be really disturbing. It has to be more than all of a sudden reality looks different to you. Suddenly everything is. You see the evil in everything, the trees outside the window, the wind, da 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 da. And again, I think that's played out through events, and they could be psychological events or psychologically orientated events. But I think it's role playing games, so we have to be doing stuff. We have to be trapped. We have to be, and I don't, I mean, make it, yes. You know, maybe we do have to die more, you know?
Yeah. I'm a bit soft, aren't I, on you?
Well, well, maybe.
I mean, it's easy enough to kill characters, but.
But that's the thing. Maybe if we've got more up our sleeves, if we've got more characters we can be, then we can be the people that experience these grisly deaths.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when Hector
Yeah.
died, I think it's one of the funniest things we've ever done, but at the same time, it was pretty horrible. It was pretty, and I think there was a little bit of a sort of oh, you know that oh, he's dead. He's just had his throat
Well, when
torn
this
out.
was,
I know it was by Timmy the dog, but still.
but it was amazing, wasn't it? Because all I wanted to do was kick the kid in the shin, and I rolled a super result and broke his leg, and then Timmy naturally comes over and wants to defend, but you rolled a super success as well. So it was kind of, oh, right. I mean, I think the penny dropped for me a little bit before maybe everyone else or whatever. I mean, I didn't mind at all. That's what I'm saying. And I think maybe.
I mean, that was, it was a good death. I mean, if you want to talk about RPG deaths, that is one of the best I've ever
Well,
witnessed.
especially in Cthulhu. I mean, forget the big monsters.
Yeah.
But if we, I don't know, if we were more, if we, I mean, so with to talk about Dead of Winter again, you've got this raft of characters, and you can kind of build up your hand of more and more characters, and they get killed off, so you're kind of looking after a group of characters. And if we introduce that at the beginning, that we're each responsible for, say, a stable of five or something, three, whatever, then people would know that we're responsible for those different characters. Or you just go super blunt, and if you're when you're out, you're out, and that's that.
I like the latter more than the former, but I don't like the latter that much.
Yeah.
No, you see, the trouble with me for the former is that it then becomes a bit of a funnel, like a character funnel, and then you sort of don't really, you don't really care about them because they're just a resource, and you know what I
No,
mean?
but see, well, I mean, I do, but I think, but that's where you're assuming that the whole game is just a process of going through the motions, and we're supposed to be trying to create something a little bit disturbing and horrific and shocking and all of that.
That's true. That's
And
true. That's true. But isn't part of it then identification with that character or feeling like, as you said in our little chat, group chat, that it's about stakes, having a personal stake.
But that's the thing. If there's a strong enough, clear enough, big enough stake for everyone, then everyone's going to want to survive. But also, I mean, there's this funny flip side with role-playing games, is that if you have certain mechanisms in play, you will encourage players to act more adventurously and wildly and not play defensively. And that's a question to you. Do you want us to be always backing off, or do you want us to be rushing in?
No, I in this scenario that I'm starting to formulate, I want you to be not either. I want you to be basically, you can't avoid it, basically. I mean, without giving away too much, we're talking about doing it in a very confined space where you need to, it's survive or die, basically. It's defeat the thing or die, essentially.
And you've shared with us your little seed of an idea. And do you still like the idea that we record a kind of session zero where
Yes,
we map out our
absolutely.
normality, if you like? Because that's
Absolutely.
good
And
fun.
look, I don't mind previewing it a little bit because actually it is it this is actually from a published scenario and I just found I hadn't really read it properly, but then looking at it, I thought, ah, you know what? This could be perfect. There were two from and you know, whatever, from Sandy Peterson's book, The Abominations. I can't remember what it's called. It's a modern day Call of Cthulhu collection from Chaosium. It's really good. It's got, you know, and there's one set in a remote cut-off hotel. So it's, you know, classic The Shining and all of that business, which personally I think could work better, but because it's very, very intensely focused around just the characters. You know, you're kind of almost alone in this hotel, the group. But the one you like the sound of more, and I actually think is more interesting, is the one set on an oil rig. in the North Sea. I suppose the challenge there will be that there are a lot of other characters around. There's the crew of the oil rig, and you kind of need them there for it to work. And I wonder whether that then will lead to a lot of, investigation and slow down the pace. And I'll have to think about how to address the things you talked about.
Andy, there are a million things you can do to just take people partly out of the equation. You don't, you know, don't, you know, you can keep it about the group, no problem. And I mean, and with this thing about character death, it could be if you die, then you're just out for that episode. That's it. You don't come back. Like I did with Barry after Hector died. So you're out for that episode, but then starting with the next episode, someone could come back in if we want to keep the
Yeah,
group.
you pick up one of the yeah, and but your original question about doing a session zero where we build the group together, absolutely. I think in this particular setting, it's even more important because that they have to make sense in terms of their roles. You're not going to have a vet on an oil rig. Well, you might, but you probably won't. They've all got to make sense as people that would be on an oil rig. So there's that part of it. But I think the other part is the personal horror has to. I think you're right. There's group threat and group stakes, but I think there also has to be something personal around, as you said earlier, around the individual agendas as well, or their quirks or their
And
personalities or
this is
something.
kind of like the bloody alignment debate, isn't it? We're kind of,
Is it?
yeah, because they don't, the characters don't know about the horror unless, except for one, let's say. Let's say one person knows about the horror just for the fun of it. Or maybe two, they're in cahoots, whatever. But let's say the majority of people don't know about it. We don't know what, what kind of agenda is that? So really, we're talking about their kind of their character sensibilities, how they tend to behave. Are they selfish? Are they distracted? And so those are th that to me is sounds more like alignment than actual motivation.
Yes. But let's say you've got the classic character type that's in all of these stories, the one who wants to save themselves and doesn't care who else, dies so that they can survive. That is a pretty strong indicator of how you're going to play. And it's quite a good kind of hook to hang a character's behaviors on, for
Well, so
instance.
I mean,
There's the one that
that would be interesting in terms of the roles in character creation or some initial roles. So, what have I got? I've got the unnameable character here. I don't know, what would you in Cthulhu, what would you put selfishness under? What would you roll against?
I would put it under intelligence, I suppose, maybe, or power. I mean,
Because we
there's no
could, well,
morality.
because we could make a, we could create characters and we could do, let's say, a power roll, to see whether this character is going to, how they're going to react in that situation.
I mean, the way it generally works for it's not explicit, but the way it generally works is the less power you have, the more weak-willed you are, essentially, is what it translates to in Call of Cthulhu. So it makes sense. But then there's the other type of character, another classic, is the one that has to find out no matter what the cost to themselves. That is a classic horror character as well, and other genres. So we could kind of almost say, let's find these really singular, powerful drivers for each one, You know, there's the classic heroic type that wants to save everyone, even, you know, at their own expense and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that could be kind of fun. I don't know.
I think that's good, because I think what it might create is it might support that kind of that tension between the characters without it just being an argument. So everyone's got kind of...
Yeah, they'd be very...
Go on.
Yeah, there'd be very clear reasons why people are doing what they're doing. And consistent.
And if almost the characters are hung on those particular traits or tendencies, we reduce the complexity of the characters to a degree, but then as a group we vary the stats, we vary the abilities, we vary the
And then of course there's also your, well, for want of a better word, your job, because you're not there randomly. You're there for, you know, you don't end up on an oil rig by chance. You're there for a reason as well. And what's really interesting, and you'll probably realize this if we play that scenario when we play it. It's very much like one of those old Doctor Who episode series. You know, where they're in this place and there's all these different people doing things, and some of them have got very bad intentions, others don't, and then these outsiders come in to try and you know, sort out the problem. It's essentially that setup. So if and even though they're predictable and cheesy, those old Doctor Who stories, there was something immensely enjoyable about seeing all those different agendas clashing up against each other in the good ones.
But you know, I mean, as well, I mean, someone, you know, in the game, the League of Eternal Guardians game with Niall Athatep yesterday, someone said, oh, it's a bit like Doctor Who. And I said, yeah, you know, it's like any number of time-space traveling characters that you might know. But yes, absolutely, Doctor Who. And, you know, and I think there's probably more of a Doctor Who influence on League of Eternal Guardians than I care to admit, generally, because Doctor Who goes exactly to the place and time where the problem is occurring, and that's exactly what happens in League of Eternal Guardians. So they always start with the problem, with the action. So my suggestion to you, Andy, is we've got to start knowing that something is wrong, and we don't have to have the explanation for it. We don't have to understand it. And that's where the horror will be that we have to tap into. But stuff has to be happening, that we have to be off routine. After, you know, we've done our session zero, which will be really good fun and everything, set it all up. But we're starting with William Hurt's belly popping open. That would be my approach.
You mean John Hurt? I mean, William Hurt.
William Hurt. well, altered states then. We're doing altered states.
Very
actually.
Young William Hurt. Yeah, but well, it's interesting you say that, because I think one of the... I'm not saying it's a problem, because I love our White Dwarf sessions, is that you have very tenuous linkage to what's going on. And it's like you get the letter kind of thing. And then you have to go and find out what the hell is going on to any degree before you get to the action. And I have to say, I love those sessions. I love those games. I love all the messing about and the character interaction. But, you know, it takes a long time before anything nasty and scary happens in most.
But
of
I think day, yeah. I think it's possible to up the action, to up the stakes, up the motivation, up the pace, and still have those kinds of revelations and discoveries.
I do feel it's a big part of the game is uncovering the terrible reality.
Yeah, but you know, but what all I'm saying is that start uncovering the terrible reality in the first minute. Because, you know, we don't have to wait.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
Because there's
I feel like we've kind of
because there's
come.
loads of stuff to uncover.
Yeah, those you're right. And actually, one of the structural problems with those white door scenarios is that there's so little in them. There's very few like dramatic moments, so you can't just blow your load in the
I
first
mean, but
hour. I've had to keep teasing, and so I need to add more stuff in, basically.
I
I
mean,
think
for
is the
me,
answer.
every single session I run, if I've set the scene up, the opening scene up, and it hooks people in, I don't really need anything more than that. I need the distance. I need to know what's in the distance. But the thing I need in detail is that opening gambit.
Yeah. I think I'm starting to have a good handle on this. Starting to. I think I know where I want to go. I think the other thing is I and this is going to be a bit artificial for us. If we're trying to create a good horror podcast, each episode has to create horror. Every single session, we have to make sure we start and end, not necessarily always start, but certainly have to end with horror, because that's how all these horror podcasts go. It's like that bit at the end is the bit that makes you want to listen to the
Can
next
we
episode. So we
do
have to.
if you know, seeing as we're not really having comedy in the episode, in the sessions, could we do fake adverts to go in between?
We could. It would be ripping off the Lovecraft tapes, though.
Okay, sorry.
But no. I mean, if we can come up with good ones, these would need to be scripted, though, surely, wouldn't
Oh
they? I mean, I don't think you can just riff.
No.
I don't think you can improvise a good advert, do you?
Unless you're Orson Welles, drinking
This wine
cheap.
is very good. Very good. A good wine. Cheap. It's very cheap. It's very red. I like
Anyway.
it. Is there any more? Is there any more wine? So, thank you, Barney. I feel like we have gone into more detail than anyone ever wanted to hear about this, possibly even us. So
Yeah, I don't
thank
know.
you
I don't know
for
if
giving
you've
me your
got out
time
of
today.
this what you wanted. I don't know what you were hoping for, but it's
I was
something.
hoping for untrammeled
There we go.
genius. And what did I get? And what did I get?
One of those you got. When people have been kicked off the train, and then they get on that old hand, the hand cranking rail. That's the kind of genius that I think we got to today.
Well, if that's what we got to, then I'm very happy, Barney. And yeah, I will look forward to our next session. I'll look forward to possibly more League of Eternal Guardians, possibly more Alluvial Plains. I don't know what your intentions are there. All good
Well,
stuff. That won't mean anything to probably won't mean anything to the Grizzly Peaks listeners, but the expedition listeners will
Well,
hopefully
yeah.
know what we're talking
Yeah.
about. So
Thank you. Thank you, Andy.
I'll let you go on with your night there.
I'm looking forward to this. I'm gonna do my best. I'm gonna do my best to keep a straight, horrified face.
I was gonna. That was the one question I didn't really want to ask you, so I didn't want to insult you. But I'll ask it now before
Yeah,
we
go
go.
on.
Can you go 2 hours without cracking a joke, Barney?
I
That's my
know where
big
the I
question.
well I thought you said without cracking up. I was going to say I know where the mute button is. Can I
Oh.
go 2 hours without cracking a joke? I think I can. I think I can.
Okay.
This will be the test.
This will be the test. I got to ask the question of myself as well. We're British. It's like hardwired, isn't
I mean,
it, to take the piss
the
out of
thing is though,
things?
you cackle away. You cackle away when something terrible happens,
I
or when someone
know.
has a bout of madness or something. You love it.
I know that I physically have to gonna have to stop myself from doing that, because that is a problem that TJ noticed. I think you all know, but
We're gonna
yeah,
have to. We're gonna
don't
have to. We're
laugh at
gonna have to
people.
have bits, aren't we? Where we go, right? Okay. Now that we've done the funny bit, can we just go back and do that again?
Yes.
Take two.
Or we just have outtakes.
that we
Or,
almost,
yeah,
yeah.
we have our, or we say, okay, we've done the serious bit. Now we can be silly. Gloves off.
Okay. Do you think it'll work that
Either
way
way.
around?
No. We can be funny starting now. Right, go.
Yeah. Like I said, I wanted to be a doctor in our little Discord group. I said I'll be a doctor, and then Spencer says, "What did like you made some joke about it?" So we're our own worst enemies in terms of
We
generating.
are, and this is why this is doomed for failure, really. But either way, I think we'll get something good out of it. It just probably won't do what I'm hoping it'll do, but that's okay.
I just think you've got to force us to make hard decisions, and we've got to be scrabbling for our lives, and because of horrible things that are happening, and I think that's got to be coming thick and fast. And if we can get to a break, like if we can fight our way to catch a pause. That would be an achievement. Like you've got to be so busy with it, I think, that we don't have time to crack wise.
I really want to talk about this other topic now about
Go on
combat
then.
and about whether that. Okay, let's talk very briefly about combat. I have a feeling that combat, too much combat, can deflate the horror in the game. That because either you're going to get killed, which probably, can be horrible, but it ends the game rather quickly, or you're defeating these things, in which case they stop being scary because, oh, you can just shoot them. What do you think? Do you
I
think
don't,
we
I
should try and
don't,
minimize combat?
I think when we had that showdown with the deep ones, in Walberswick, that was actually pretty rough, pretty scary, especially because then more were looming and all of that. So and so you set that up really well, that then we're rescued by the bigger enemy, if you like. So I think there's that kind of structural thing.
But if it's just fight after fight after
No, no, no,
fight,
no, no, no. I'm not saying it's fight after fight, and I
no.
don't want to. But okay, graveyard. It's the graveyard. I've just got my ankle torn by some zombie coming up out of the ground. I can't run as well as I used to. So,
I see where you're
yeah.
going. So it's just dramatic things happening
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
peril. It's not necessarily combat.
And then
It's yeah.
if I can get to the gatekeeper's hut, then that's your cue to get an NPC to, the gatekeeper who's just locking up, to quickly unlock the door, get his shotgun, and blast the thing in the head. And then he asks, "What the hell was that?" And off we go. So I don't
Yeah,
think
that's good.
it's at all,
Good.
and I think that's where you use the dice rolls when people mess stuff up. Oh, you've dropped your lighter. That's not going to help you much later on, is it?
Especially if you're on an oil rig.
Well, indeed, indeed. But
With
you
that.
can sow the seeds. You can sow the seeds of trouble based on fumbles and errors.
Yes. Just yes. You're right. And I think structurally these scenarios need to be tweaked because they aren't structured that way, where there's stuff happening every 20 minutes, every 30 minutes, or at least not the way I run them. Well, look, thank you again, and we will re-adjourn in 2 weeks' time for more of our wonderful new adventure that we've been running. And I got to say, I think we are getting better as a group at actually making good, fun stuff happen at the table, and that's very encouraging to me. And I think we are pretty good right off the bat, and I think we're getting better.
Super. And it's lovely to take the time to chat with you outside of the game too, Andy. From the other side of the pond. Goodbye.
Okay, speak to you
See you.
soon.
Ciao.
Bye.